Hello and welcome to the Tales of Sardra Medu. Characters, stories and events from the post-apocalyptic world of Ersa Latari and the political intrigue of a surviving civilization in the jewel of a corroded empire. In today's episode, we meet Captain Jilloat Levi and Petty Officer Skirlet Wilfoth as they try to settle into their new lives as educators and are bored to tears by a garrulous headmaster during an unduly long faculty meeting which eats ever further into their weekend. We also meet the acclaimed Flugtag racer, the Crimson Gammon, as he ruminates about his career and his future prospects for both work and romance. Sit back, listen and enjoy Episode 7, Baron Halwyn's School of Patriotic Arcane Defense. This boring old Ua was getting on Jilloat's nerves. It was well past close down on Dachi afternoon, and the sun would be setting at any moment. 7 solid days of work. Well, 7 days of work. Okay, at least 7 consecutive days of attendance. All right. Almost consistently, at his place of work, for almost all of a standard works 10. Putting up with all the entitled little gobshite students, running around the place and asking him questions about the arcane. A man needed his rest. Jilloat would usually be 6 tankards down and half a week's wages deep into a dice or card game, with the remainder reserved for his favourite madam at the Row of Rigid Spears. But the Baron just would not stop talking. It was as if he were totally blind to the utter disinterest the faculty had in what he was saying. Or, for that matter, what he ever said. Jilloat guessed that this sort of pig-headed lack of self-awareness was Baron Halwyn's compensation for the loss of his blood right. The only conceivable explanation for how he functioned in society without collapsing into a quivering wreck. Anyone else cursed with the Baron's sheer absence of aptitude, intellect, charisma and spine, whilst blessed with even a modest capacity for self-reflection, would be utterly defeated. Fortunately for the Baron, he was barely endowed with the ability to catch his own image in a reflective surface, never mind turn his limited perspective inward. Jilloat expected that Baron Halwyn's metaphorical blindness was so essential to him that it had spilled over into the literal and the physical. This would explain why the halfwit never brushed his hair or presented himself in a manner befitting his station. Even a mundane Baron should have standards. Were it not for his poor presentation, his lack of physical fitness, and his aberrant dispossession of the arcane inheritance, Brymont would have fit the mould of an officer in the Royal Land Forces. Entirely self-involved. Entirely self-interested. Entirely without genius, character, or merit. And yet, absolutely sure of himself. Jilloat had enjoyed a long and storied career serving under buffoons like Brymont Halwyn in the RLF. He knew how to manage them, but had sorely hoped to be free of them when he returned to civilian life. Now, the Mercs had been less populated with his sort, as they had a tendency to promote talent over breeding. Certainly the only way that someone like Jill could receive a commission. You could never fully escape it though. Turds, it seemed, always floated to the top, in every walk of life.
So, I think that we should expand recruitment of the faculty to include the non-Wren. We don't have enough in the budget to afford any more proper educators,
said the Baron, repeating the conclusion of a conversation that barely contained any other interlocutors.
So, what do you all think?
He finished. Skirlet responded, much to Gilliwat's irritation. The parents won't like that at all, Headmaster. Imagine trying to explain to the Agostos or the Hallabies that you let a filthy Scaly or Feeblood live in the same building as their little princes and princesses. Gilliwat shot Scarlet a murderous look. She had spent a decade in the Royal Navy, under the command of idiotic and verbose officers. She should know better than to engage. One prompt, and the old fart would be off again.
Well, we wouldn't let them sleep in the manor, of course. We can have them use the stables or the old storage sheds on the top field, surely. And we can tell the parents that we are teaching adversarial studies, learning more about the current and future threats to our great nation. If there's one thing the patrons of Baron Halwyn's School of Arcane Patriotic Defense will get behind, it's preparing their children to get the drop on the monstrous and foreign elements that threaten the great city. Once the royal forces take back the city, they will need...
Brymant was back in full swing again. Gilliwat could not take much more of this. The Baron had another hour in him at least, and there was not nearly enough alcohol or caro in the city to make this man or this job interesting. Gilliwat lolled his head over to one side, staring dead-eyed at his long-time travelling companion, letting Scarlet silently know that she was footing the bill for tonight's excursions if she gave the daft bastard another reason to speak. Gilliwat loved Scarlet. Not romantically, of course. Whilst they had knocked boots occasionally when they were wasted, bored, or if the feeling took one of them, they were both far too close and far too licentious for any sort of romantic entanglement to take hold. They knew each other's foibles and mores too intimately. Far more like comrades or maybe backwards boondock wildlands family than lovers. It was Scarlet who had convinced Gilliwat to settle in the city and make a bit of coin without risking their skin. She'd never asked him to directly. In fact, come to think of it, he might even have suggested it himself. Their last few contracts had taken them through the Nunez Gap, a fact they both boasted endlessly about in the taverns and brothels of the city, earning them the polite disinterest of the cattle-like civvies, but more than a few free drinks from other veterans and mercs. Little compensation. The gap had changed them both. Gilliwat never wanted to see the horrors of combat or the terrors of the untamed regions again, and he most certainly never again wished to see Scarlet suffer the way that she had. He felt a creeping cold move up his back, and his hands and feet became suddenly numb. This often happened if he dwelled on the past without a drink in his hand, a pipe in his mouth, or a woman astride him. His thoughts darkened as images of swamp water, slick with viscous red blood, filled his mind, and the smell of salt, damp, rotting wood and putrid flesh filled his nostrils. He was right back there, in the suffocating darkness of the gap, alone, except for the bloated floating corpses of his contubernium, which he could not see, but which brushed against his elbows and thighs as he waded through the waist-high water, his breath heavy from carrying his heavy pack, and his voice hoarse and rasping as he called out for his missing comrade. His recollection became confused as he sank deeper into it. How long had he been here? How long had she been missing? How had he survived? It was all muddled in his mind. The bodies were decaying and distended. That couldn't be right. Couldn't have been there for that long. He heard another gravelly and scratchy voice calling to him, off to the right in the darkness. not far away, but muffled, as if obscured by the mangroves. He moved quickly towards the voice, but found that he was suddenly stuck in place, held by some invisible force. He tried to discard his backpack, throwing the straps from his shoulders in an attempt to provide some maneuverability. As the weight of his pack released, the anticipated splash as it should impact the fetid water never materialized. As Gilliwat reflexively turned to attend to the incongruence, he found himself completely disorientated, feeling as if his entire body were now weightless and floating in an endless void, unable to determine bodily orientation. He called out again, shouting as loudly as he could for Skirlet. His voice sounded muffled in his own ears. Something wet, cold, and wrinkled grabbed his hand, and as he looked up, he found himself face to face with a mockery of his own visage. All of his features present, but twisted into an uncanny and natural grimace, covered with welts, tears, and rends to his flesh. He watched as the face began to swell and disintegrate before his eyes. The cold, wet, wrinkled thing that had grabbed his hand squeezed tightly in it as he looked down to observe what had captured his wrist. He was surprised to see a clean, jeweled hand with well-filed and trimmed fingers resting gently on his own tightly clenched fists. He heard a new voice now, closer, softer, and gentler than before, as if whispering in his ear. Gilliwat found himself looking into the gentle and concerned face of Skirlet, his body relaxing suddenly and dramatically from a tension he had barely been aware of, her words acting as a soothing balm against the distressing ruminations and echoing in his mind.
Jill, you are safe, secure amongst friends. Be still, be tranquil. You are amongst friends.
As he found his consciousness slowly returning to the room, he found the scene to be unfolding with barely a divergence, as if mere moments had passed. Halwyn was still monologuing. Skirlet sat paces away from him, relaxing into her Chesterfield, with a look of boredom and disinterest plastered across her face, with only the slightest hint of her index finger protruding from under the elbow of her crossed arms, pointing in his direction, her lips muttering, signalling that she had been rendering him aid without attracting the notice of the blind clown. Gilliwat felt a sudden, sharp, stinging feeling in the palm of his hand as his grip relaxed. He could feel tiny shards of glass rubbing over one another in his grip, and could sense the tap, tap, tapping of blood and black unguent dripping through his fingers and onto his boot.
Bollocks.
Oil of Olisthos was expensive, and he'd promised Nilfheid he'd bring it for her. Skirlet's voice, interrupting the Baron from across the room, was jarring and unexpected. She stood quickly, her sudden movement enough to stop Brymont mid-sentence. Gilliwat and the Headmaster both turned to face her with confusion plastered across their faces. Before Baron Halwyn could speak, Skirlet paced over to him, placed the back of her hand on the seated man's forehead, and spoke with concern.
Headmaster, you look dreadful. Are you feeling okay?
The Baron, quite taken aback by the sudden interruption and display of concern, was at a loss to respond. And as he stammered through his response, Gilliwat could see Skirlet making recognisable esoteric gestures behind her back and moving her lips ever so subtly as he spoke. Gilliwat was astounded and impressed by the barefaced boldness of it.
He didn't know whether to interfere or to bust out laughing.
I feel quite all right, Miss Wilfolf.
Scarlet interrupted him again. It seems you're coming down with a fever, Headmaster. You should get yourself off to bed immediately, and we should call for a healer. As she spoke, Brymont's face began to take on a slight tinge of green, and his eyes appeared almost to sink in his skull, casting a dark shadow.
Now that you mention it, I do feel a little under the weather. Oh dear.
The Baron interrupted himself with a slight retch and stood suddenly from his seat. He tried to politely excuse himself multiple times before being forced to rush to the door of his study, colliding with his heavy oak desk and Scarlet's green Chesterfield as he raced to his exit. Scarlet waited until Headmaster's racing footsteps had faded away down the corridor, before turning to Gilloat with a wide smile and a playful flick of her shoulder-length brown hair. Scarlet spoke as if nothing had happened at all, and with a wide grin, she said, "You look like you could use a drink, Jill."
Part 2. Listen and enjoy.
It is said that disappointment is a sort of bankruptcy. The bankruptcy of a soul that expends too much in hope and expectation. Grok had never expected much. He'd never had it easy, but he'd never been ambitious. When opportunities presented themselves, he took them. If they came to naught, so be it. He was therefore abundantly aware of the role good fortune had played in his life. His path had not been easy, for sure, but it had brought him fame, a modest fortune, and the opportunity to do what he loved. Nevertheless, he knew these were not the rewards that were owed to him by virtue of his good character, strong work ethic, or some divine right. They were products of what amounted to little more than a short run of good dice roll in a game of chance that was far from over. Everything he had could be taken away, whether he fought hard to keep it or let it all slip away from him. He knew he could skew the odds little. The house always won in the end. Perhaps he was just a little melancholic today then. Perhaps a little tired. Or was he just anxious? For some reason, he was experiencing a long and lingering moment of existential disappointment and ennui. It was distracting him from the team manager's briefing. As Miss Abby Odin was just coming to the end of her situation update, Grok realised that he couldn't recall anything she had said since
the board are allowing the UWF to participate.
He'd always had a bit of a soft spot for the Federation, seeing them as a group of motivated and like-minded people who were trying to tip the scales of fate just a little bit in the favour of the little guy. He considered it grossly naive and doomed to failure, but the laughter of the gods at the plans of mortals was now as silent as their response to prayer. Who knew? Maybe they could win for a little while. They were certainly popular with the common folk right now. But so was he, and he did not like the idea of being forced to confront them on the track. Especially when the Viper's Nest at PDHQ had finished their vindictive manoeuvrings. They wouldn't allow the Federation to join in. Not unless they were certain.
What certainty would look like in this scenario would no doubt be brutal. And, he expected, less than subtle. This was going to damage his brand. Badly.
Any questions?
Miss Abiodun finished. Grok badly hoped he had not missed anything important.
That'll be everything until the rehearsal of concept next 10 day.
She smiled, recognizing the wave of relief washing over the small audience.
Until then, don't add to the population, don't take away from the population, don't get too drunk, don't get too high, and if the guards throw you in the Gend, establish dominance quickly. We'll get you out of there soon enough.
With that, the crew of the PD Guild Flugtag team got to their feet and began to bimble towards the exit, each ensuring that they shook hands with the famous Crimson Gammon before departing. Grok often found this ritual awkward and unpleasant. Most of the people rotating onto his team were either criminals or politicals. Just criminals, he guessed then. He didn't particularly like the idea of them being his fans. Now, he wasn't opposed to crime per se, he just preferred honest criminals to these men and women. There were only ever really two races on his team. Grok, aka the Crimson Gammon, and Lucigen, Lippy Lucy. Both of them hated their stage names and their absurdly written public personas. But it was just part and parcel of competing in the big leagues and being on the winning team. The Public Displays Guild didn't make any money from winning the races. They earned their gold from the event, the spectacle, and from the merchandise they could sell year-round. It was therefore Grok and Lucigen's job to be spectacular, larger than life, and to never break character in public. This was uniquely challenging for Grok, who had an avid followership from his days in the lower leagues. The PD Guild had worked very hard on rewriting his story, his history, and erasing his previous incarnation. But there were still times when his old fans would recognize him, and he'd be forced to navigate a horribly awkward encounter. Such encounters, when not intercepted early by his handlers, would usually result in harsh words being thrown at Grok after a fan or old acquaintance's patience had tired with his facade and his insincerity. As the last of the team's volunteers left the briefing room, Lucigen gave Grok a sly, waist-high thumbs up from across the chamber, exiting the room with an embellished wink and a wily nod in the direction of the manager. Quinn Abiodun was stunningly attractive for a Wren, and Grok could not understand why people weren't falling over each other to woo the magnificent lady. Grok tried not to stir or to undress her with his eyes as he approached her. Quinn was sitting on the dais in the center of the chamber, resting in a relaxed posture, leaning back on one arm, her plump legs crossed at the ankle, and holding her notebook out in front of her. Grok could see that she was squinting hard at the words written on the pages, and holding the little book just a little too far away from her face. She looked adorable to Grok, her dark-skinned face wrinkled up and her lips pursed in concentration, the gold piercings, rings and chains set about her face, reflecting what was left of the fading light shining through the translucent panes of glass in the windows. She had clearly not realized he was still in the room, and had been so focused on whatever she was trying to read that she had not noticed him approach. Grok allowed himself a guilty moment of admiration of her form, allowing his eyes to glide down from her shaved head, down her ample shoulders and towards her.
"Gods above, Grok!" she exclaimed,
starting at the sudden sight of the hulking Tuskar next to her.
"You scared the shit out of me, you sneaky bastard!"
She closed her book suddenly, placing it down on the dais, shuffling off the platform so that she could stand and face him. She looked at Grok quizzically for a moment, as the flummoxed and surprised man tried to find words, and fidgeted his large fingers with both hands interlaced.
Were you looking at my tits? She asked, furrowing her brow deeper yet.
Miss Abiodun, I would never.
He stammered, unable to gain control of his mouth and tongue. She interrupted Grok, stammering.
Did you just wait until everyone had left? Wait until I was alone and distracted? Sneak up on me in the dark to get a slice of this body?
She paused, waiting to see if Grok could get it together.
I...
He couldn't.
I know your lot's courting rituals are a little different, Grok, but you've been in the city long enough to know you can't just bash a woman over the head and drag her back to your cave.
She spoke with a tone that Grok could not properly interpret, with the primal parts of his brain having taken over in panic. He had no idea if she was teasing him. Oh God, he desperately hoped she was teasing him. But he expected she was just behaving like the usual, ignorant, entitled Wren. Quinn was loving this. She couldn't keep the game up any longer, and she burst out into powerful laughter, bent over double, clutching her large torso as it jiggled with amusement.
Your face, Grok! It was an absolute picture! Lucigen has you pegged good and proper. You are such an easy mark!
She was almost out of breath with her own self-delight now, and Grok's embarrassment had reached fever pitch. He felt his abdomen tighten and his throat close entirely to speech. He tried hard not to wear his wounded look openly, and put all of his mental energy into regaining composure, as Quinn's laughter slowly ran out of steam. By the time she had finished, Grok had regained his poise. Lucigen knew that Grok had a crush on Quinn, and had convinced him to ask her out for a drink on the mile. Too hurt and too embarrassed to follow through, Grok changed tack.
Can you imagine?
He laughed, unconvincingly, before continuing.
Did you speak to the board about how you plan to transition me when all this is finished?
He asked, feigning good humour. Quinn, noticing Grok's incongruent body language, attempted to backpedal a little and to placate the wounded team captain.
Why don't we grab a drink back at my place and discuss it there?
She said, trying to smile contritely. Grok had near abandoned all interest and expectation in his previous plans at this point. He was sorely tempted to tell the manager that he was tired and would really rather not. Nevertheless, when opportunities presented themselves, he took them. If they came to naught, so be it. He didn't know how long his luck would last, and he really needed to keep his options open.
That sounds lovely,
he said, swallowing his injured pride. That was Episode 7, Baron Halwyn's School of Patriotic Arcane Defense. Thank you to Imperial Glow for their song, Boxing Day Last Year. Thank you to Ola Ola for Sempre Voce. And thank you as always to Matt Wigton for the use of his song, The Next Adventure, for our intro and outro. Thank you for listening. And if you want to hear more fantasy fiction or actual play TTRPG, why not check out Roll Britannia or Crit Like a Girl? You can find them with us on Anchor, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts.